This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Now that the federal government has legalized hemp, investors and entrepreneurs are racing to be a part of this ballooning industry.
Oh my God, the big wall is falling, and most people didn't realize, hey, there's another one right behind it.
Federal regulations haven't quite kept up, which means the hemp business is still riddled with uncertainty and legal risks. We'll take a deeper look.
Not every theater production happens on stage. For some companies, the right venue puts the audience right in the middle of everything.
It has a particularly, I'm not going to say by any means a warm aesthetic, but it feels like a place where you can feel ghosts in a good way.
We'll hear more about a Colorado theater troupe that's using a unique pop-up venue.
Plus, we take a look into the big oil and gas measure, Senate Bill 181, and we'll hear from our film critic, Howie Mofshevitz.
But first, Colorado Democrats have dropped an effort to repeal the death penalty. As KUNC's Scott Franz reports, the bill's sponsors couldn't rally enough support in the state Senate.
The proposal was in limbo for 2 weeks as Senator Angela Williams heard concerns from her fellow Democrats. Williams says about 4 senators wouldn't pledge their support.
When you get to a stalemate in this process, you've got to make, you got to be a stateswoman and you've got to make some decisions on this, and that's what I did.
Senator Rhonda Fields was one of the Democrats opposing the bill. She thinks only voters should be able to repeal capital punishment.
I think the voters would come back and vote that it should be retained because of the aggravators that are associated with the death penalty.
Senator Williams is vowing to bring the bill back next session. I'm Scott Franz at the state capitol.
State lawmakers this week gave final approval to Senate Bill 181, the contentious oil and gas bill. The measure gives local governments more control over things like how far away new wells have to be from homes, schools, and businesses. Many Republicans, including Senator Bob Rankin, predict the regulations will hurt the state's economy.
I believe we're headed for a ban in some counties and much more restriction in others.
Now, Democrats say they've limited the power that local governments will have. Under the new legislation, regulators' top priorities will be public health and safety and the environment. Currently, that top priority is to encourage production. The new law will also grant local governments new authority over where wells can be drilled.
The changes are welcomed by those concerned that the state's rules haven't quite kept up with the industry's growth. But as KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, many others felt left out of the conversation.
There are 3 key parts to Senate Bill 181. First, it limits the number of industry members sitting on the 9-member Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to 1. Right now, there are 3. Second, it increases the threshold companies need to force pool a group of mineral rights owners. And it gives local governments more control over where new wells can be drilled within their jurisdiction. The legislation has been challenged on several fronts. From the state capitol, here's Republican Representative Larry Liston.
I think at some point in time, the industry could make the decision that, we'll just pack up, they take their rigs and take their crews, make it so hard and onerous for the industry to do business, well, then they'll just pack up and leave.
And bill sponsor Democrat Steve Fenberg.
State regulators absolutely must put health and safety ahead of industry profits.
To the oil and gas industry, which has opposed every aspect of the bill, right down to how it was written.
They crafted their legislation in secret and then stood shoulder to shoulder with those who tried to put us out of business. This is not how we do business in Colorado. This is not the Colorado way.
That's Colorado Oil and Gas Association President Dan Haley at a rally in Denver earlier this month. It drew dozens of workers and elected officials from places like Weld County, where a lot of people depend on the industry to make a living.
The language is ambiguous.
Democrats stress they talked to industry experts while crafting the policy, but Greeley Chamber President Sarah McQuitty says its voice wasn't heard enough.
You think of what could happen to our housing market. It's such an uncertain time, and so many things that are happening in the Capitol just don't seem to be thought out as well is if you brought the industry to the table ahead of time.
The chamber was one of several, including the Denver Chamber of Commerce, taking a stance against 181. McQuitty says it isn't clear about what limits local governments can put on oil and gas.
People are saying, no, it doesn't say there's a moratorium. Yes, it says there's a moratorium. Yes, you have local control. No, you don't have local control. So until we say black and white, it's a frightening situation.
Folks are rightly concerned here.
Ben Martyr is with the Colorado Petroleum Council. He points to places like Adams County. Commissioners there just approved a temporary moratorium on new drilling permits. It'll stay in place until they can suss out the new changes.
The bill could have a massive impact to Colorado's economy, its budget, schools, transportation. So many priorities depend on state revenues from this industry.
The University of Colorado Leeds School of Business estimates about 30,000 people are directly employed by the oil and gas industry in Colorado. Other studies that are mainly funded by the industry say tens of thousands more jobs are indirectly supported by development, like Colby Edgington's.
It's tense. It's really tense.
Edgington lives in Meade and drives trucks for oil rig moves in northern Colorado.
We have people that, like myself, I'm the sole provider for our house. My wife stays home with our kids. We've got a 2-year-old, a 6-year-old, and an 8-year-old. So my income and the insurance is why I'm here.
If the new bill slows down the industry, he says he'd move.
I can't support a society that could so easily just chew up an entire industry and spit them out if it comes to that.
Edgington says he's been talking with friends working in North Dakota and Texas, just in case. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
The measure's now heading to Democratic Governor Jared Polis, who is expected to sign it.
Later this month will mark the 20th anniversary of the school shooting at Columbine High School. Now, current Columbine students have started a controversial campaign to try to bring more awareness to the prevalence of gun violence.
The campaign is called Hashtag My Last Shot. The teen organizers have produced a sticker that anyone can print out and put on their ID or belongings. It says, in the event I die from gun violence, please publicize the photo of my death. Kathleen Culver is the director for the Center of Journalism Ethics at Wisconsin-Madison.
I do think that when you are confronted by a particular kind of image that shows you the results of violence, you see things in a different way than if you are protected from that image. And this has been an age-old debate in, you know, conflict reporting, for instance.
Still, she worries about what could happen to these images on social media, which is a hard space to monitor and control.
There are at least 31 states that allow some teachers or staff to carry guns in schools. That figure has grown since the 2012 shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School. But as Guns in America's Matt Richmond reports, there's no standard training or national set of policies to help states govern this trend. And a warning, this story has the sound of gunshots in it.
Butler County Sheriff's Deputy Doug Hale is a school resource officer. He goes to work every day at Lakota East High School, 25 miles north of Cincinnati. He's local law enforcement's connection to the school. Lakota East has about 2,300 students. High metal frame ceilings and a wide main hallway make the building feel like an airplane hangar.
Hey, how we doing? Guys, how we doing today?
Hale is walking the hallway at lunchtime and kids are streaming into the common areas.
I can remember when we first opened the school here 22 years ago, you know, you'd leave the doors unlocked. You know, we never had a problem.
Hale's been a school resource officer for 24 years, since before the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado. Back then, Hale was trained to wait for backup.
I had to wait for like 3 others if something happened in here. And we had to do what, you know, a quad training, and where the 4 of us would go in and we'd start clearing off stuff. Well, everything, you know how it is, when something happens, everything changes.
Everything changed after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Footage showed the school resource officer waiting outside while children were being shot inside.
And so now we're being trained, solo engagement. So if something's going on, if I'm the only one here, I'm not waiting on backup.
School shootings are extremely rare, but districts everywhere are under pressure to show they're keeping kids safe. So some districts decided armed police like Hale aren't enough. Today, districts in at least 31 states are allowed to employ armed teachers. Just a few legislatures passed laws guiding districts on how to arm teachers, In other states, it's up to local districts to come up with policies and training requirements. In Ohio, it's up to local districts. So a state gun rights lobbying group called Buckeye Firearms Association stepped in. In 2013, they began offering training for teachers and staff who would carry firearms.
Enroll. Safety gear on. Safety gear on.
In this three-day training session held in 2016, teachers learned how to stop an active shooter. It included role-playing and a crash course in police tactics. Buckeye Firearms Executive Director Dean Reek says about 200 districts across the state have attended. It was carefully crafted to fit school shooting scenarios.
We went to the trainers who train police and train SWAT and train military. So we went to the people who were at the top of the food chain for this kind of training.
In 2018, parents in Madison Local School District near Cincinnati sued the state, saying that three-day session isn't enough. Ben Adams is a plaintiff in the suit. His kids go to school in the district. He says armed personnel, like school resource officers or SROs, aren't the problem.
We have two SROs in our building, and we've never said that that was a bad idea because we know that they're properly trained, they have experience.
At the end of February, a judge dismissed Adams' lawsuit. The judge in Butler County found that local districts could arm teachers under existing state law. The state requires 700-plus hours of training for school resource officers, but the judge found that didn't apply to teachers. So districts are free to rely on Buckeye's training. Research on whether arming teachers makes kids safer is sparse. People tend to come down on the question based on how they view guns. Ben Adams is a gun owner himself, and he works in the local fire department. He thinks about what he's seen as a first responder when he imagines a teacher at his kid's school trying to stop a shooter.
Adrenaline kicks in. You have to have training to guide you through those moments. I've just seen it. I can't not know that now.
Adams is debating whether to appeal the judge's decision. He's also considering moving his children to another school district. For Guns and America, I'm Matt Richman.
Guns and America is a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. Find more at KUNC.org.
It's been just over 3 months since the federal government legalized industrial hemp. Now, investors and entrepreneurs are clamoring to get in on the hemp industry. But as KUNC's Esther Honig reports, they may be disheartened to learn that many legal barriers still exist around making and selling hemp products.
Just how much interest is there in the hemp industry? Well, for starters, about 10,000 people attended the 6th annual NoCo Hemp Expo last week. More than 200 companies displayed mostly CBD products. That's the oil made from hemp flowers that could be used to treat everything from depression to chronic pain. Alex Buescher was one of just two people there offering legal advice.
So a lot of the questions are about kind of what happened with the farm bill.
Buescher is an attorney specializing in cannabis. After decades of restrictions, Congress passed a law stating hemp could be treated more like a crop and not like its cousin plant marijuana. It's what everyone in the hemp industry had been waiting for.
And in actuality, it really kicked the ball to the states to regulate.
Developing federal regulations, like how hemp is processed and sold, could take years. Until then, Buescher says we're stuck with a patchwork of inconsistent state laws. And that hinders this industry, which could soon represent $22 billion. Recently, a shipment of Kentucky hemp, where the crop's been legal since 2014, was seized in Oklahoma, where it's still heavily restricted.
A police officer pulled over a truck full of hemp, didn't understand the difference between hemp and marijuana, so they think it's the biggest marijuana bust of their career.
Oklahoma state prosecutors want to charge the drivers with marijuana trafficking. And there are other areas where this industry still operates with high risk and in legal gray areas.
This is the tea, herbal hibiscus. Smells amazing.
Conference attendee Allison Glennie enjoys tea infused with CBD.
Oh yeah, that's great.
It's from the company Steep Fuse that also makes CBD coffee. Co-founder Devin Jamrose thought passage of the Farm Bill meant he'd finally get his products onto the shelves of major retailers across the U.S.
Oh my God, the big wall is falling, and most people didn't realize, hey, there's another one right behind it.
The Food and Drug Administration is still working on regulations for how CBD can be used as a food ingredient, a health supplement, and a pharmaceutical. Meantime, companies like Steep Fuse remain limited on where they can sell their products.
Kind of boils down to risk tolerance. Like, are they willing to take on having the product in-house? And a lot of places won't, but more and more places will.
It also limits access to CBD for many consumers, like Tanjanika Daniel, a veteran of the U.S. Marines who came to the expo from Georgia.
So I'm 80% disabled, and I have chronic back pain, and I also have PTSD. So I use it for all of those conditions.
In Georgia, residents need a state-issued card proving they have a serious illness to get access to CBD. Daniel says that's a barrier, especially among the veteran community.
Veterans are the largest population taking opiates. So once we get our hands on this is going to revolutionize everything, really change the game.
But veterans, like other consumers, still risk repercussions from employers, namely police departments, security companies, and airlines, who often have a zero-tolerance policy for any cannabis use. After pressure from lawmakers, the FDA announced this week it will prioritize work on regulations for CBD, starting with a public hearing next month. Esther Honig, KUNC, Denver.
And just an interesting sidebar, attorneys for two immigrants say U.S. authorities denied their clients' applications for citizenship because of their work in Colorado's marijuana industry. The state has allowed the use and sale of marijuana to adults since 2014. However, a U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services spokesperson says the agency has to follow federal law, which still considers marijuana illegal.
Bomb cyclone, avalanches, and now highs near 70 degrees.
What even is happening?
Erin, I've lived in Colorado my whole life, but this weather whiplash, it seems a bit stronger than usual.
It really does, but I can say it's never boring. I mean, you just wake up and you don't know what to expect, really.
You grab your raincoat, your snow boots, whatever will get you through the day.
Yep, flip-flops too, just in case.
You never know what to expect, but what you can expect is some definite natural wild beauty, some amazing culture all over the state, and for me to talk about the outdoors.
We knew this was coming.
Earth Day is coming up later this month on the 22nd, plus the 20th through the 28th is National Parks Week. And on Saturday, April 20th, all entrance fees will be waived.
That's kind of cool. I'm guessing also there will be some events, maybe even some hiking.
I love hiking, but there are some super fun events from National Junior Ranger Day to Bark Ranger Day, where dogs get to take their humans for a walk.
Aww.
To get involved with these events, from Rocky Mountain to the Great Sand Dunes, all you have to do is check out nps.gov. And speaking of the outdoors, like really, really outdoors, NASA is beginning testing on 5 uniquely different habitation prototypes for their Lunar Outpost project, one of which was designed right here in Colorado. And you could say it is expanding opportunities to live in space.
I see what you did there. Sierra Nevada's Space System Division in Lewisville is taking a new approach to life in space. In this case, LIFE, it's an acronym for Large Inflatable Fabric Environment. Now, once in space, this module will be inflated to create a 3-floor habitat that has all kinds of cushy things like an exercise room, science labs, a medical bay, and of course, living quarters.
It's almost like a big, durable space bubble.
Yes. Spokesperson Kimberly Schwantz says there's a reason they're going with an inflatable concept. It's launch-friendly size.
So if we had to launch something that big, the rocket would probably have to be much bigger. We can actually launch off of a conventional rocket. So this actually allows us to have a much bigger space than we would otherwise if it were hard shells.
Schwantz says the LIFE module consists of many layers, including a material called Vectron, which is used in bulletproof vests and is 5 to 10 times stronger than steel. In a few weeks, the ground prototype will be sent to Johnson Space Center in Texas for testing from NASA.
All right, now let's jump into some of that Colorado culture, specifically into the world of theater. Now, sometimes the venue where a show is held is just a backdrop. Other times, it plays a starring role. In Denver's Globeville neighborhood, a new production is taking its temporary location to heart. KUNC's Stacey Nick has more.
It's cold, and it's getting colder. It's almost time to go.
The opening lines from Aggregate Immateriality are a pretty apt description of Denver Theater Company Control Group's new show and its latest venue.
When we first got in here, it was freezing, so we had to do a lot of, like, try to keep us warm.
Actor Bailey Harper plays the show's lead character.
Slightly frightening.
During a recent rehearsal, she remembers her first impression of the building at 4800 Washington Street in Denver's Globeville neighborhood.
And just kind of, like, more like I could feel it in my skin. Like, I was really aware of what had happened here. And now that I've become comfortable in it, I feel like I can only see what we're putting into the space.
Up until the late 1960s, this building was a slaughterhouse. Artistic director Patrick Mueller is giving me a tour of the long-vacated basement.
Or is it part of the show? Come on.
That's the warm-up. Oh, okay. There is no blood-curdling shrieks during the performance.
In one room, he points out graffiti covering the walls, much of it from the men who used to work here.
Kill floor closed 3/29/68. It was very, very sad. And a recurrent theme, James Ciccante retired December 1, 1967, and I feel good. And there's a bunch of retirement messages with that tagline. Yeah, it sort of brings alive the people who are here.
That's part of the reason why Mueller chose to produce this show about death in, of all places, a former slaughterhouse, to show the contrast of what happened here with the lives of the people it impacted.
It has a particularly, I'm not going to say by any means a warm aesthetic, but it feels like a place where you can feel ghosts in a good way.
Things happened here. Death on a massive scale. You can feel it in the walls, in your bones as they walk through each room, trough drains and ceiling hooks. There's even a sign next to the women's restroom. Remove your gloves, knives, and aprons before entering. I guess it's not really a place for the living anymore.
Most of Control Group's performances are in these types of found spaces, as opposed to a traditional theater. The building itself is part of the experience, and at times, the audience will get up and follow the actors through the space. Also woven into the production's narrative is the story of Globeville. Settled in the 1880s, the North Denver neighborhood was the site of the Globe Smelting and Refining Company. It was isolated by the railroad and the Platte River, and later by the construction of Interstates 25 and 70. In the 1990s, the area was deemed a Superfund site. But while the play is largely about death and dying, artistic director Patrick Mueller is careful not to give that label to Globeville.
I absolutely don't believe that Globeville is a dead neighborhood, but there was a passing that happened, actually several of them, in terms of the industry that fed the communities of Globeville.
He's cautious because he doesn't want the production to become a beacon for gentrification. That's why Mueller worked with local neighborhood organizations, not only to find out more about Globeville's history, but also to find out how the theater company could be sensitive to the community.
Arts are an inherently gentrifying force in a certain way. We can, as artists, we can offset that or we can ignore that. And I think, whether you're coming in for, 2 months like we are or for 2 years or 20 years, you have a responsibility to that.
Because while the slaughterhouse is long gone, the community of Globeville is still very much alive. Stacey Nick, KUNC, Globeville.
Control Group's new show, Aggregate Immateriality, runs through April 28th.
The celebrated filmmaker Agnes Varda has died at the age of 90. Her groundbreaking work as a filmmaker, photographer, and installation artist is known all over the world. She was also a close friend to our critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver.
Agnes Varda died just 2 months shy of 91 years old. Her long career changed the cinema.
She made her first film in 1954, and she herself appeared this past February at the Berlin Film Festival with her last film, an autobiographical piece called Varda Bayanyes. I knew her, and she changed how I saw and thought about the cinema. That first film, called La Pointe Courte, told two stories simultaneously. One's about a young couple having a hard time in their marriage. They go to a town on the south coast of France where the man grew up to try to work things out. The other story has to do with an actual situation. The health department wants to close the shellfish beds because of pollution, which creates a conflict with the fishermen. The short of it is that the combination of actuality and stylized fiction, mixing trained actors with local people playing themselves, and shooting in natural light on actual locations, made La Pointe Courte the first film of the French New Wave. Over 5 years before the boys, François Truffaut, Jean-Luc Godard, and others, got into the act. Varda told me that when she asked Alain René, who in 1959 made Hiroshima Mon Amour, to edit the film, he refused. Varda, to say the least, was persuasive. She asked René why not. He said he couldn't work on it because she was actually doing what he was still figuring out in theory. But he edited the film. I've always thought that Varda had one of the coldest eyes in the movies. She staged and filmed sights that made other filmmakers flinch. Her 1988 Kung Fu Master is about a love affair between a 14-year-old boy and the mother of his closest friend. The mother's played by Jane Birkin, one of Varda's closest friends, and the boy's played by Varda's own son, Mathieu Demy. When I asked her how it was to film her young son in bed with her friend, Varda admitted that she would set up those shots and then leave, because it actually was too hard for her to watch. But she made the film. Le Bonheur, an English happiness from 1965, looks bright and cheery, with a pretty couple with two pretty kids. Then the husband tells his wife that he's now doubly happy, meaning he now has a new pretty girlfriend. It doesn't end well. I said to Varda that I thought it was a vicious film. She shrugged and said that people did such things. But after her husband, director Jacques Demy, died in 1990, Varda's work grew softer. I knew Agnès Varda for 38 years. We met at the Denver Film Festival in 1981, started talking about Godard, and struck up a friendship. She could be gentle and sweet, and she could be demanding, insistent, and single-minded. But if she'd not been so tough, she would never have made her films. For a woman filmmaker, France was worse than America, and one of Varda's greatest contributions to the movies has been to open the way for women, especially for women making films about women. Look at Cleo from 5 to 7, One Sings the Other Doesn't, Vagabond, and her nonfiction films, The Gleaners and I, The Beaches of Agnès, and from 2017, Faces Places. And in person, she could make every young woman she met believe they could become an artist. I owe plenty to Agnès Varda. She was always there as a figure of unrelenting integrity. She taught me a ton about observing. One time she dropped me in a scruffy bar on her street in Paris and told me to sit there for a while and watch. These are the faces of France, she said. She introduced me to her city, Paris. Not the monuments, but the neighborhoods, the small museums, the quiet flea markets. And she showed me constantly that art is crucial for the world. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital.
Colorado Edition is also made possible with support from our KUNC members.
Thank you.
If you enjoy listening, please consider making a contribution in any amount you like at KUNC.org.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.